From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with writer Mary Gordon about religion, martyrdom, and mother-daughter relationships. Her novel Pearl is now out in paperback. It's about a mother's effort to understand her daughter's public act of martyrdom. Also, British actor Clive Owen. His films include Croupier, Closer, and Sin City. He's currently co-starring in Spike Lee's new film, Inside Man. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Basic Instinct 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Mary Gordon, has written novels, memoirs, short stories, essays, and a book reflecting on Joan of Arc. Terry spoke with her last year about her most recent novel, Pearl, which will be out in paperback in a couple of weeks. Before we hear that conversation, let me read what James Carroll said in a review of Gordon's book, Joan of Arc. He writes, quote, "This quintessentially American writer, with her skeptical eye, her impatience with sentimentality, and her readiness to skewer pieties of all kinds, has also, in her fiction, proved to be motivated by a profoundly spiritual curiosity. She is a critic of institutional religion whose writing is deeply rooted in Roman Catholic sacramentality." Unquote. Gordon's novel Pearl also fits that description. The story begins on Christmas night, 1998. Maria, a single mother, gets a call from the State Department saying that her daughter Pearl, who has been studying in Ireland, has chained herself to the flagpole in front of the American Embassy in Dublin. Pearl hasn't eaten in 6 weeks and is refusing food and drink. In exploring what led Pearl to put her life on the line, the novel reflects on politics, guilt, sacrifice, and mother-daughter relationships. Along the way, it also explores the line between martyrdom and suicide. Mary Gordon told Terry that when she was growing up, martyrdom was like a job description. You could be a nurse, a teacher, or a martyr. Terry asked Gordon what martyrdom meant to her as a child.
Well, first of all, what it meant was you would go straight to heaven. And that was always the phrase, straight to heaven, like was the express train. And I remember before we were being prepared for our first communions, which is we would be six or seven, we were told that we should pray for a martyr's death. So you would have these seven-year-olds saying, oh, my God, I better pray that and it was the communists at that point, because it was the 50s, I better pray that a communist will say, either say there is no God or we'll shoot you. But you didn't want to be shot. You basically wanted to live to have lunch. But I would do things like when I was about 9 or 10, I would put thorns in my shoes to try to walk around to experience the preliminaries of martyrdom so I'd be kind of toughened up for the real thing. But I didn't want my feet to hurt, so I would put the thorns in my shoes, then I'd try not to step on them. So it was a sort of a equivocal appetite for martyrdom, and nonetheless always feeling that I wasn't quite up to scratch because I wanted to live, because I didn't want to die.
What adults in your life knew that you were walking around with thorns in your shoes?
Nobody. They would, you know, really, even in my family, that would have been considered extreme. It was a real secret that I had to keep. And I knew it was strange, but part of the cult of martyrdom was that nobody understands you. You know, martyrs are never understood by their family. Their families are always telling them to shape up. And so it was part of the glamour of martyrdom that you would be misunderstood by the ordinary bourgeois world.
Being misunderstood was a classic part of American popular culture then, too. James Dean was
right.
Misunderstood. All of teenage culture was misunderstood.
Exactly. We wouldn't have known what to do with ourselves if we'd been understood. And so the roots of that are very deep and wide.
Did you ever tell any nuns about this?
Oh, no. I would never tell anybody. Mm-hmm. Because it was almost like it was too special for anybody, and I also didn't want anybody to tell me to stop, and I knew they would.
Now, in your novel, the mother was brought up Catholic, as you were, and she intentionally doesn't expose her daughter to the literature of martyrdom. What is her fear of exposing her daughter to it?
Well, her fear is fanaticism, and her fear is that a desire for purity, and the theme of a desire for purity is very important to me in this book, because I think it's a desire that doesn't get named in our culture, and so it enacts itself in very strange ways. And it is essentially a desire that the world be less mixed than it is. And Maria, who is the mother, believes that all this talk about the cult of martyrs and the cult of purity is really a love for death, and she wants her child to love life rather than death. And another aspect of modern culture that I wanted to explore in this book is what happens to all these ideals, which are larger than life and even life-denying, if they are in fact denied. It seems to me that they come out in different ways. I think that the girlhood impulse to idealism and to purity now has really relegated itself to anorexia. And I think there is something particularly in young people that desires purity, and it only now gets expressed in terms that it seems to me are really perverse, because they go back to the individual body. They don't really stand for anything larger. They're not an idea. They're only another emendation of the body.
Do you see anorexia as a quest for purity or just thinness?
I think that it's a quest for purity in the guise of thinness. That is to say, you know, girls who are eating a carrot stick for lunch because they want to get into a bikini are one thing, but anorexia, I think, is a real desire to be purged of fleshliness. And that desire to be purged of fleshliness, I think, is a desire to be of a purity that our species simply isn't made for. But it's a very strong and, I think, quite mysterious impulse.
Did you expose your children to the literature of martyrdom?
No, absolutely not. And I have to say they have no interest in it. One of the my children are less romantic than I am, with a capital R. And, you know, they wouldn't dream of doing the things that that I did when I was a child. And they're much more practical. They actually do more good in the world, more effective good than I did with all my dreams of heroic goodness. And so that's very interesting to me to see what they do. But they're not extremists. They're not attracted to the extremes that I was when I was younger.
What were the other extremes you were attracted to?
Well, I think, you know, when I'm coming of age in the 60s, I really believed that, and because I thought I was an artist, I thought that you had to experience everything. And you couldn't say no to anything. You couldn't be afraid of drugs, sex, or rock and roll. Or political extremism, that in order to be fully alive, you had to be very risk-taking and push things to their extremes. And I don't think that my kids have that impulse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Mary Gordon. Her new novel is called Pearl. So in your novel, you know, Pearl not only decides to become a martyr for the cause of the IRA, but also for something more personal. She develops a kind of self-hatred of her body. Her mother thinks that the things she did would spare her daughter from feeling that way. And just as I think a lot of mothers felt that bringing up their children in a feminist context would spare them the kind of pre-feminist self-consciousness and self-hatred that so many girls felt. And in a lot of instances, it just didn't work. It wasn't enough. It wasn't, there seems to be something deeper.
Yeah, and this was something that I really wanted to explore about motherhood, that when you have babies or young children, you think, well, I'll do it this way and the world won't touch them. And often that doesn't work out. And I think particularly in the case of feminism, one of the things that feminism hasn't touched at all, and I'm a feminist, I'm not afraid to use the F word at all, but one of the things that the women's movement hasn't touched because the culture has been too strong is this notion of the hatefulness of the female body. You know, women are more obsessed with weight than ever. There are more products on the market that tell us that we're wrong, there's something wrong with us. The boom in plastic surgery, which seems to me just bizarre, has come in the wake of the women's movement. So obviously we have done nothing to say that the female body is not in itself inherently hateful. And if you have a girl child, you say, oh, you know, I'll put her in Oshkosh overalls when she's little, and, you know, I'll cut her hair short and she can play soccer with the boys, and I'll never make her wear high heels and never tell her she has to wear a girdle and she'll love herself. It didn't work so well in face of this pervasive cultural message that there is something inherently loathsome about the female body. And that makes me very sad.
Have your views on why so many girls and women as well have this discomfort about or hatred of their own bodies? Have your views changed on that from, say, the 60s or the 70s?
No. The only thing that I think that it's in the interest of whatever dark forces they are, and I don't know who they are. It's too simple to say capitalism. It's too simple to say men. I don't exactly know what it is. All I know is that every woman I know spends too much time thinking about the way that she looks. And if she doesn't spend time thinking about the way she looks, then that can be a kind of self-hatred, because at its best, adornment, I mean, I have to tell you, I'm a person with 200 pairs of shoes. So it's not like I want to, you know, make myself out to be Emma Goldman. At its best, adornment is play and joy. At its worst, it's anxiety and self-loathing. And what makes me sad is that for women, either adornment or a lack of adornment more often is a source of anxiety and self-loathing than of joy and play and freedom.
Do you feel like you have a good fix on whether self-adornment is joy and freedom in your life or an expression of self-loathing or somewhere in between?
Well, you know, I'm not a perfect person, so it kind of depends. I know that shoes are a perfect place of pleasure for me because I have no anxiety about my feet. So,
In spite of the thorns that you used to wear there.
Well, maybe that's why. My feet have been purified by a martyr's blood, so I deserve all those shoes. So I can say that the parts of my body that I feel secure about, namely my feet, I can really play with. And then there are other things that, depending upon how I look that day or where the 10 pounds is one way or another, can be either fun or self-punishment. So it's a very, I think, vexing and difficult problem. But look, it's only very recently in the history of the planet that we assumed that women were similar to men in most ways and might be equal to most men. My particular theory is that's why the world is having a nervous breakdown, because of the relatively new news that men and women might be equal. It's making everybody crazy because it's a lot to absorb as a species, and we've had to absorb it very fast.
Give me an example of why you think that's the cause of the nervous breakdown.
Because I think that what all fundamentalisms share is a desire to repress women. That I was in Israel one time, and I went to the Wailing Wall, and the men had to pray separately from the women. I went to the Dome of the Rock. The men had to pray separately from the women. I went to the Tomb of the Holy Sepulchre, and the women weren't allowed in the sanctuary. And I thought, the way to get all these people to stop fighting with each other is to have women step in the sacred places, and they would all join together as brothers and tear the women limb from limb. Because it seems to me that that is the thing that unites all fundamentalisms. What I don't exactly understand is the women who join with them in this desire to exclude themselves. That's a real puzzler for me, except I think that there's a lot of fear in the world, and I almost feel very sorry for the poor species. It seems that we're just rocked by fear and fear of the unknown. And I think one of the unknowns is how to live together as partners who might be not identical, but at least equal.
Mary Gordon, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with author Mary Gordon, recorded last year when her novel Pearl was published.
every time we talk on Fresh Air, I like to ask where you are in terms of your own spiritual life, whether you're going to church. Because throughout your life, or throughout your adult life, there's been this kind of tug of war between your kind of spiritual commitment to an interest in Catholicism and your disagreements with the organized religion part of it, the hierarchy, the church's views on birth control and divorce and abortion and women in general. So where are you now? What are the couple of places that you feel most at home being Catholic in?
Well, I have a church that's in my neighborhood, which actually was the church that Thomas Merton was baptized in. And there are some wonderful people there that I can really be with. And a few priests, and particularly nuns. I did a long piece a couple of years ago for the Atlantic Monthly on the state of American nuns, or actually nuns worldwide. They're really radical. They really are self-giving. They really are large of heart. And I have met in these people an expansiveness of spirit that moves me very, very deeply. So it's the people that I see in these places that live in a way that is more suggestive of a radical and deep openness, which is what I think we're on the earth for.
You know, I remember what I think was our first interview in the 1980s. And you were in Philadelphia doing, I guess, a signing and some interviews. And you had left your two children behind for the day in, I guess, New York. And I remember you saying that you not only missed your children, you physically missed having your baby in your arms. And I think now, you know, of you being the mother of two adult children. And what a different experience of motherhood that is.
Oh, yeah, I could have had a million babies. You know, I mean, just babies and little children, that was easy for me because they had no moral life. But when I had to come to terms with the fact that they were independent, moral, and intellectual beings that wouldn't necessarily do what I wanted, that was when I found motherhood more difficult. The animal parts of motherhood I could do with, you know, my hands tied behind my back. I could change diapers and clean up vomit and spill juice and make Play-Doh all day long. But when somebody said, you know, I'm not going to do what you want me to do because I don't want to do it, that was the more difficult part. And then to watch them, and I'm really lucky. I have wonderful children who, my daughter particularly, has, you know, stood up to me and bucked me. And I think that one of her first sentences was, I'm not you. And she's not me. She's actually a lot better than I am. But watching them say to me over and over again in words and in language, I'm not you, has been a very great moral challenge for me. And I miss, you know, I miss them terribly. My daughter's in California, my son's in Michigan. And, you know, ideally I'd like to be one of those Italian mothers that has a three-story house with the children, you know, and their families and children on the upper levels. I think that would be my idea of a good time. I very much miss the presence of these animal children in my life. I miss the smell of them. I miss cooking for them. And I do think the best part of my life is over because they live so far away. And I adored having young children. And it's one of the losses, it seems to me, that aging brings. And they're terrific and they have their own lives, but it's not as much fun.
Why do you call it a moral challenge? Like when your children started saying to you, I'm not you. Why a moral challenge and not just a kind of crisis of self-confidence and ego?
Because I think you have to judge whether they're saying they're not you and whether their decisions are ethical and right in their own terms, which might be different from your terms. So you really have to start thinking, are there other ways of being in the world besides mine that are still acceptable? And that's a real challenge. Because you'd like everybody to be, or I want everybody to be exactly like me. My idea of a good time is if everybody says to me, you're absolutely right, 24 hours a day. and my husband once said to me, on your tombstone, it's not going to be only the words, I was right. It's going to be, I was right and you were wrong. So for my children to not have been clones of me was a challenge for me to look at them not as myself, but as people really, really other from me.
You said something very funny in a piece that you wrote, something very funny about your son. You wrote, and again, he's an adult now, you wrote, he's the kind of boy who wouldn't have gone out with me in high school.
Exactly. You know, he's very, very handsome, and he's, you know, he's really hot, and I would have been absolutely outside the sphere. I mean, he's very kind, so he might have danced with me occasionally, but I couldn't have measured up to his girlfriends at all. He's a cool guy, and I didn't go out with any cool guys in high school.
That's really funny.
I mean, my son would not have been in the my son was on the basketball team. I went out with boys that were in chess club, if I went out at all. It just wouldn't have happened. And it was always a surprise to me. I kept saying, where's this person come from? And I was very interesting as a woman and as a feminist to have to see that I had this kind of eminently beautiful, eminently desirable male. And how, as his mother, did I give him permission to be that in the world, which is a gift and a wonderful thing, but say to him, you know, a lot of guys use the gifts that you've been given in really terrible ways, and that's not okay. And that was a very interesting balance to have to try to keep.
Mary Gordon, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. Her latest novel, Pearl, will be released in paperback next month. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. And from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with writer Mary Gordon. Also, actor Clive Owen on what his acting roles have taught him about gambling and car chases. He's currently co-starring in Inside Man. And David Edelstein reviews Basic Instinct 2. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's conversation with writer Mary Gordon. Her latest novel, Pearl, is about to come out in paperback. Terry spoke with Mary Gordon last year when Pearl was first published.
Do you know what your next book will be?
I have a couple of projects. I'm working now on a book about my mother, who died 2 years ago. And she.
I meant to ask you about her because you had a beautiful piece about her, a magazine piece about her having Alzheimer's, in which you raised all kinds of interesting questions, like if you go there to visit her at the home where she was and if she enjoyed the experience but then immediately forgot it, was there still a point in you going if it was not something that was going to be remembered beyond a minute? So it was a wonderful piece.
Yeah, and she was really in a state of, I don't know whether it was Alzheimer's or dementia, for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to write a book that I'm calling Circling My Mother, which is to try to recover from before those 11 years a mother that that was not quite so damaged, and to get back to trying to know my mother despite the stain of those extremely painful years. So I'm doing that. I have another novel in my head. I have a series of novellas that I'm working on, and I'm not quite sure which project will come first.
Is it hard to find the memories of your mother from the period before she was sick? I mean, has being sick overshadowed all the other memories?
It has. And so I feel that it's a very important work to know her fully, because she had a long life. She was 95. And to recover that life, to recover the mother who was delightful to me, even when she was problematic, she was also a source of great delight. So it is a labor, but I think it's an important one to sort of dig out from the rubble of her last illness a delightful mother.
And where are you going to find about who she was?
Well, one of the pieces that I'm working on now is about my mother and her perfume, that I discovered a perfume that my mother had used, which kind of went off the market for a long time, which was Arpège. And I was in the airport in Paris, and I said, oh, my God, Arpège, I'll smell it. And I smelt it, and a whole world opened up to me. So I'm interested in exploring her through her scents and through the perfumes that she used, which were a way of my being delighted by her and being delighted by the possibility of being female.
In trying to reconstruct your mother's life, are you starting to think about things that you have experienced as a mother? So you think of your mother from the perspective of a daughter, but you're a mother of two grown children yourself now, and you've just written a novel about a mother-daughter relationship. So are you trying to understand things from your mother's point of view that you never perhaps noticed before? And I'm wondering if any of the mother-daughter issues that you bring up in your novel Pearl, if you think any of those existed for your mother.
I think my mother was so radically different from me in that, when I say this, it sounds snobbish or elitist, and I hope to be able to get past that. My mother was a peasant. My mother, she was very, very smart, but she absolutely did not believe in self-consciousness. She thought she was in the grips of fate. She would have called it God's will. But she didn't think she had a lot of control over her life, or she was not particularly interested in shaping it. And she was absolutely uninterested in self-examination or self-analysis. You know, and she would say to me, well, you know, you dwell on things. You just harp on things, and you just make yourself miserable. I just live. And the fact that my mother was essentially an unself-conscious person makes her so different from me. I mean, my mother would just had virtually no self-censorship mechanism. She would just say anything that came into her head, with no notion that that might leave a mark on me. And I was so conscious of everything that I said potentially leaving a mark that it was almost as if we had very different experiences as mothers. And my mother was also physically handicapped. She was a polio victim. And so I was her caretaker in a way that I was determined that my children were not going to be my caretakers. I mean, I was just going to run marathons to prove that they didn't need to take care of me. And when I see some of the rages and anxieties in myself that my mother had, I always say, oh, God, I really don't want to be that. I think we share a playfulness and a love of pleasure. But essentially, because she was an unself-conscious person who thought she had really very little control over her life, we're such different people that I don't think our experiences were very similar.
Mary Gordon, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too, Terry. Thank you.
Mary Gordon, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. Her novel Pearl is about to be published in paperback. Coming up, actor Clive Owen, star of the new Spike Lee film, Inside Man. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie Inside Man, the latest film by director Spike Lee, Clive Owen plays Dalton Russell, a bank robber who's the brains behind a particularly intricate, thoroughly planned heist. He prides himself on being several steps ahead of the police throughout the robbery. Dalton has a bank full of hostages and a list of demands. In this scene, he's on the phone with the chief hostage negotiator, played by Denzel Washington. Dalton is teasing him because he's just thwarted the cop's attempt to eavesdrop inside the bank.
You shouldn't eavesdrop on people.
Well, you better get used to it, pal. It's not going to be much privacy where you're going.
You're damn right. This time next week, I'll be sucking down pina coladas in a hot tub with six girls named Amber and Tiffany.
More like taking a shower with two guys named Jamal and Jesus, if you know what I mean.
Maybe you like that kind of thing, huh?
All right, here's where we stand.
I don't need your status report, Sir Pigot. I tell you where things stand.
Sure, I just meant...
Here's where things stand. You're getting me what I asked you for. You'll have it ready in the time I gave you, or you'll sit by and you'll watch me do just what I said I would do. Clear?
Very clear. I'm trying to get you what you want, but you got to understand this. You know, it's not like the city of New York has 747s waiting around for days like today.
I understand that if you don't get my plane ready, then you might as well send a hearse.
Please, let's focus on how we can both get what we want, all
right? Hey, you're not listening. You get me what I want. I won't kill anyone.
All right. I'm on it. Let's just try to keep everybody calm, okay?
Don't I sound calm to you?
Yeah, you do.
Clive Owen, after a string of movie and TV roles in Great Britain, first was noticed in the States when he starred in the 1998 thriller Croupier. He played a struggling writer who led a double life, working as a blackjack dealer to do research for a novel. Since then, he's appeared in such films as Gosford Park, The Bourne Identity, and I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. More recently, he starred with Julia Roberts and Natalie Portman in the film version of Closer, and Bruce Willis and Mickey Rourke in Sin City. Terry spoke with Clive Owen in 2004.
I want to ask you about Croupier. This is such a terrific film, and in this you play a writer who takes a job as a croupier running a blackjack table in a casino. And let me just play a short scene from the film. The film has a lot of voiceover narration from your character. And he's usually talking about himself, both as himself, Jack, and as Jake, the main character in his novel. Let me play some voiceover narration from your character toward the end of the film. He's at the blackjack table.
Chapter 10. He watched their faces as they lost, hour after hour, night after night, relentlessly. He questioned the conventional wisdom that gamblers are self-destructive. He had come to believe that in reality they want to destroy everyone else. Their families, loved ones, everyone. F*** over the whole world. Without emotion, he watched them go. Jake stayed.
That's Clive Owen as the croupier in the film The Croupier. This is a really such a great film in part about the meaning of risk. Like what kind of risk is worth taking? When are you being a sucker? What are some of the things you did to get into the spirit of this film? You know, in which you're not a gambler. Your character is not a gambler. He's opposed
he's very
to gambling.
Against gambling. Yeah.
Yeah, but he takes a lot of big gambles that just aren't in the casino. But anyways, so he takes this job at the casino. As a croupier at the blackjack table, what's some of the preparation you had to do for this, even in terms of just like learning how to deal?
I actually went to croupier school for a couple of weeks and actually trained with the guys that were teaching there, literally just slotted in and did it properly for 2 weeks, which was a real insider's look at the way casinos work, really, because I was taught as they were taught. We were taken around the casino. We were forbidden to gamble because all croupiers are. And I remember the thing that struck me more than anything was it's one of the few environments where there's still a lot of cash casinos, which is unusual in this day and age, to have so much cash flying around. So ultimately, they are obsessed about not being ripped off. So when they're teaching croupiers, they drill into them every single day, do not think you'll ever be able to take a penny from this casino. We've got everything covered. You'll never get away with it. And I remember thinking that sort of slight paranoia was really striking. And it is related to the fact that, you know, you're handling money all the time. It's not credit. It's, you know, and there are stories of people having developed scams, croupiers developing scams. They don't tell you this. You hear it from other places of scams of how to actually, you know, get money and take it from the casino. And then I remember the other really important thing we discovered very early on in the movie is often with voiceover, you'll play the scene and Mike will shoot the whole movie and then the voiceover is laid on afterwards. You put the voiceover on. And there was on the first or second day, I was at a blackjack table and I was just generally doing some dealing. And Mike said, yeah, we'll lay some voiceover over that. And it concerned me a bit. And I went round to see him in his hotel room later. I said, I'm a bit concerned about this because it feels very unspecific to lay the voiceover just over general dealing. And I said, I think it needs to be more specific than that because often the voiceover is in the present tense. It just didn't feel tight. So we came up with this plan where I would go off and learn all the voiceovers. And then when we actually came to shoot them, I would speak them out loud. And then we would do a take where I just thought them. So there'd be people there, there'd be extras there. And the thoughts were very, very specific. So if I thought about a particular character or a person that was at my table, I could flick them a look. I could. And it worked very well. It didn't mean to say that Mike had to use all of that, because obviously he can cut away, he wants to do whatever he wants to do. But the times where he did use it, it made the voiceover very, you felt like you were inside the guy's head. It made it very, very present. And I remember that was a key discovery that we made together early on in the movie.
Clive Owen speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. He co-stars with Denzel Washington in the new film Inside Man. Terry also asked him about a series of action shorts created as ads for BMW, shown on the internet. Each starred Owen at the wheel of a BMW, outracing bad guys on a high-speed car chase. The shorts were directed by such luminaries as John Woo and John Frankenheimer. Terry asked Owen how he got involved in shooting the high-tech ads.
It was really through Croupier. Croupier just sort of made its impact in America, and then I got this call saying, did I want to do a series of commercials for BMW? And I said, no, I didn't, because I was meeting, things seemed to be opening up a bit. I was meeting lots of interesting people, and I thought it wouldn't be a very smart, cool thing to do to just jump into a bunch of commercials, because I didn't really know that much about them. And they came back and asked again, and I said, no, I really don't want to do commercials. I don't want to do this. And then right at the wire, they sent me the script of the first one, which was this 10-minute proper, fully-formed little movie script, very well written. They said, we've secured John Frankenheimer and Ang Lee to do the first two. And I suddenly thought, this project is really unusual. It's very different, and it's, you know, they're attracting serious quality people. So I literally jumped on a plane the next morning, arrived in LA, and was taken straight from the airport to a night shoot with John Frankenheimer to shoot the first one. And I'm just enormously grateful that it didn't pass me by, because, as you say, I ended up working with some of the world's top directors, and it was a very exciting project. To work with that caliber of director was really exciting.
So what are some of the differences between how, say, John Frankenheimer and John Woo directed you behind the steering wheel?
Yeah, I remember that the very first one, that Frankenheimer is regarded as the king of the car chases, and he took... His really is one long car chase, and he showed me examples of actors driving fast in movies and examples of people that did it well and people who didn't do well and why they did. And he had the whole thing down to absolutely every cut of the chase. So he knew when he was going from steering wheel to rearview mirror to road to, and was incredibly specific and knew down to literally like 3-second shot. Like, this is a bit you're just going to just pull the wheel this way, just literally 2-3 seconds and he'd be out of it. But he was that specific, and you realise that's why he's so great at doing car chases, because you know, he puts that much attention and tension to it.
I'll remind our listeners that John Frankenheimer, among other things, directed French Connection too. So when he was showing you examples of good and bad acting behind the steering wheel, what were some of the things he pointed out?
It was really just to do with whether they looked like they were really driving fast. They looked in the situation. And some people didn't. When you watched them, you thought, they're not connected with the speed of the car, with everything else. And other people looked very much in the situation. I really just looked at it, and it was, you know, the same acting principles apply. There was nothing particular about it. It was just you've got to really make people feel and believe that you're in this dangerous, you know, high-speed car chase. I think he was the one that invented the whole notion of, which I did a lot of, because a lot of people said, did you do a lot of the driving yourself? But what they used to do is they used to rip the steering out, put it on the other side, place a stuntman driving the car, give me a dummy wheel, and as long as you frame out the guy sitting next to me, they can throw that car around and drive it pretty fast with me actually in it, so you can see the world racing by outside the window. And I did quite a lot of that, and I think it was John that was the first guy to do that.
What did John Woo, what kind of advice did he give you?
I mean, he was, I can't remember anything, you know, specific John Woo said, but I was a big fan of John Woo, and he's, you know, brilliant at putting together action, and there's a sequence in his one that was pretty, you know, one of the more stunning car sequences of the whole series, really. But
Is that the one where the car's spinning around a lot?
Yeah, and there's a bridge being slowly going up, and there's a car, you know, there's a whole sequence where the car eventually just spins to a stop, and the wheel literally is on the edge of this very high bridge. It's a pretty stunning car stunt.
And were you in the car for that stunt?
No. They took the stunt guy got as close as he could do, then they would replace the car with the wheel on the edge and then put me in it.
We've established that your face registers a lot in films. In the BMW films, basically, it's mostly you behind the driver's wheel, and your face has to express a lot. In Croupier, your face has to express a lot, certainly in I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. What was it like the first time you saw your face on screen?
It's very strange. I wouldn't say that was the strangest thing, because you're used to seeing photographs of yourself. The strangest thing is seeing the whole of you, really. The first time you see yourself on TV or on film, walking down a street or turning around, it's the perspectives that we don't get that is the most unusual. You think, oh my gosh, I walk like that, I look like that from that angle. That's the sort of oddest thing, to see yourself that objectively. It's a very unusual experience.
Were there things you tried to fix or change about yourself after seeing your full body from every perspective?
It's strange, though, because I'm sort of wary. There are always people going to be advising you that certain aspects of yourself, the way you talk, the way you carry yourself, could be better. You know, your posture could be better. Your voice could be better. It could be clearer. And I'm always a bit wary, because I think ultimately acting is about, you know, you can't be too contrived. You can't be worrying about things like that. Ultimately, you've got to. It is an emotional job that demands a commitment. Of course, there's always an element of skill, and you know, you learn and improve and get better. It is a craft, but I'm wary of too much of it. So I am in a similar way. I'm wary of changing things that other people think it'd be better. You know, I'm 6'2", but I don't often stand up very tall. But I'm comfortable in the way I carry myself, and I, you know, suddenly if I start, you know, standing up much straighter, and it just feels different. It feels less like me, and I feel I'm becoming something else, and I'm wary of that.
Well, Clive Owen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Clive Owen, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. He stars in Inside Man, the new Spike Lee joint that also stars Denzel Washington, Jodie Foster, and Christopher Plummer. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Basic Instinct 2. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. The lurid 1992 thriller Basic Instinct starred Michael Douglas as a San Francisco homicide detective and Sharon Stone as a wealthy novelist who might also enjoy killing men with an ice pick. The scene in which Stone's character is interrogated by pasty middle-aged male detectives and reveals that she's not wearing underpants was an instant and enduring sensation. It took 14 years and several directors, but Sharon Stone is back, without Michael Douglas, in Basic Instinct 2. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
So, is she as, you know, revealing this time? That's what everyone asks when they hear I've seen Basic Instinct 2. And I have to deliver the bad news. No. You get a glimpse of the forest, but not the trees. You do see quite a bit of Sharon Stone's body. And let's face it, the peep show aspect was the hook of the original. The only suspense in the sequel comes from whether Stone at 48 can compete with one of the most formidable bad girls in cinema history, Stone at 34. Basic Instinct 2 is so stupefying that there's nothing else to think about except the way of all flesh. I still remember the first full glimpse of Stone's Catherine Tramell in Basic Instinct. She's sitting on a terrace overlooking the wild Pacific breakers. She hears her name uttered by the detective played by Michael Douglas and gives a tiny laugh, as if amused even to inhabit the same sphere as this hapless mortal. She knows she can control his eyes, his emotions, even his chemistry. It's no wonder that on a DVD commentary track, Camille Paglia breathlessly proclaims Catherine a pagan goddess from the cult of antiquity. As written with entertaining shamelessness by Joe Esterhaus and directed in a gorgeously overripe style by Paul Verhoeven, Basic Instinct is peerless swank noir. Basic Instinct 2 is not about a 48-year-old Catherine Tramell. That might have been fascinating. It's set only a few years after the original, and this time, instead of a sunny, foggy San Francisco, the setting is a chill, blue-gray London. Why, I don't know. It's not very erotic. Another mistake was hiring Michael Caton Jones to direct. He couldn't even make the Profumo sex scandal of the movie Scandal sexy. The opening is at least wild. Catherine slays her latest lover, a British football star, by driving his car off a bridge while simultaneously pleasuring herself. It's camp at 110 miles per hour, but gets points for outrageousness. Unfortunately, the screenwriters, Leora Barish and Henry Bean, don't seem to know they need to top that, and the movie settles into a dreary talk fest. Catherine's prey in this film is a starchy British shrink, played by David Morrissey. The court appoints him to examine Catherine, who's on trial for poisoning the beloved athlete.
I shall be present during the evaluation.
Well, that's fine by me. I will be asking Miss Tramell some fairly personal questions, but she doesn't mind you being present.
My client understands, and she agrees I should be present for...
Maybe Dr. Glass is right, and we should be alone for this.
Catherine, I strongly advise you not to contemplate
having... So, is this where we're going to do it?
So she does it. And it doesn't take the shrink long to get her number. He sums her up at the inquest on the stand.
Well, I would say extremely intelligent, gifted, accomplished. Yet inside, I believe, she vacillates between a feeling of godlike omnipotence and a sense that she simply doesn't exist.
If released, is she likely to commit a violent crime?
I believe Miss Tramell's behavior is driven by what we might call a risk addiction. A compulsive need to prove to herself that she can take risks and survive dangers that other people can't.
Why would a person do that?
Well, the greater the risk, the greater the proof of her omnipotence. Her existence, really.
Yeah. As if all that Freudian stuff is going to save him from her clutches. Basic Instinct 2 is like a joke on Freud played too slowly, at half speed. But even if it had whizzed along, it would have been superfluous, since Esterhaus's original hurtled past Freud and into mythic Camille Paglianism in the first 15 minutes. And Stone's Catherine needs a more cartoon macho antagonist, like Michael Douglas. Morrissey was terrific as a scandalized politician in the marvelous miniseries State of Play, but in the first half of this film, he's too stolid. And by the time he gets sexually obsessed and starts flashing his choppers like Clive Owen, the audience has moved way beyond him. The basic instincts to which he succumbs include stupidity. I don't remember Stone mugging in the first film, or dropping her G's and slinging her lines like the spawn of Mae West and Clint Eastwood. It's painful. My guess is that the only person who'll enjoy this travesty is the exiled original screenwriter Joe Esterhaus, who'll no doubt be savoring the spectacle of his pagan goddess thudding to earth.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Hyperion Books for Children, publisher of the new picture book John, Paul, George, and Ben, by author and illustrator Lane Smith. From the Everett Foundation, working with the nonprofit Medicare Rights Center in support of Medicare for All, online at medicarerights.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ray Davies. He's just released his first solo album. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hey, my friend, you can't run away from time. They say you can't fight fate, time won't wait. You can't run away from time.